Update. Talking Bollocks with FBT Gyms. Unleash your fitness potential with no contract and full class access. FBTGyms.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Till your body is okay. Walk it hard and slow. When you feel it done.
The hip knocker.
Episode 211 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly supported by FBT Gyms. It's me, COB.
It's me, Tidy Flower.
When we started this podcast, I think we thought it would only be people from the inner city who'd listen.
I know, and now we have listeners all over the place, even as far as Talla.
Sorry to hear.
So this is a message to everyone in Talla. FBT Gym have opened up their new state-of-the-art location now, offering not only top-of-the-line equipment, but also resources, classes and events that will help you build connection among members and an overall support of the fitness community.
And if you're lucky enough not to live in Talla, why not join one of their other locations in Swords, Coolock or Drogheda?
Do these locations have the classes and supportive community as well?
Of course, that's what FBT Gyms are all about. They also offer personal training, heated chamber classes and a Hyrox affiliated.
Unleash your potential at FBT Gym for only €44 a month with no contract, full class access and locations in Swords, Coolock, Drogheda and now Talla.
Sign up at fbtgyms.ie today. So today we're joined by
Selena McDermott.
Selena, you've come in to talk to us today about the Stardust tragedy and the inquest involved in that and the long battle for justice that not just your family, but all the families involved have had. Do you want to give us an intro to who you are and what your connection is to this tragedy?
Yeah. Right. So I'm Selena McDermott from Eadmore, originally from Eadmore Crescent. And my mother had eight children and I'm the youngest of the eight. And three of my siblings died in the Stardust. So Willie was 22, George was 18 and Marcella was 16. So, yeah, so it was a big, massive disaster for everybody that was in the Stardust. But that was our family, you know. So my mother, she was just like any other typical mother back then, you know. Everything was all about the kids. And my father was a fireman in Tarastry, D-Watch. So he was actually off duty that night. And so that sort of made it an awful lot harder for him when the Stardust happened, you know, when the disaster happened. Yeah, so yes, I was the youngest in the family and my two older sisters, June, she lived a door away from the family home. And my sister, Breed, she was living with her husband, Jerry. So it left the rest of us in the house. So I have a brother, Jim, as well. So there was Jim left in the house, Willie, George, Louise, Marcella and myself. Yeah.
What was life like growing up in that house?
That was great. Yeah, it was mad. It was like we hadn't got much, you know, sort of way back then. It was like the bleak 80s and like everybody knows the 80s to be like, you know, you got on with what you had sort of, but everybody knew their neighbours, helped one another out. And it was that sort of atmosphere. And in Eadmore Crescent, it was sort of playing out on the road, playing rounders, playing, you know, like it was just like you hadn't got much, but you had fun, you know. And then, but there was also an awful lot of unemployment back then. So everybody was helping one another out, you know. We had very good memories. Like I have great memories of Eadmore Crescent. You know, and all the girls, the pals I hung around with and everything. And my mother always said, thank God for the neighbours that she had in Eadmore, because it was a lot of them that got her through the years, the real hard years, especially the first 5 to 7 years after the tragedy, you know. Yeah, but we'd good times. Music was a big thing in our household, you know. Music was always a big thing in the household. It was always being played. Well, apart from when my dad came in from work or came in with a few drinks on him, you know, get that shite off, you know, sort of anything. But yeah, so music was a big thing. We were always playing and records, and there was always a bit of fun in the house. It was full. Yeah. It was full and it was mad, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds good. It sounds chaotic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was actually. Yeah. Yeah.
You obviously just mentioned there that you lost three siblings.
Yeah.
In the tragedy. Mm-hmm. What were they like?
They were great. And a lot of people just say like, Jesus, like, Selena, you were only 11 when they died, like, you know, but I remember them as if it was yesterday, you know, like Willie, 22, and he was a big lad, very lovable rogue, you know, and he was sort of the, because he was the eldest boy, he was sort of, like, my mother always called him, he was the one that looked after everything, you know, even though he was only 22, you know, but yeah, he loved his music as well. Big, big Dublin supporter. So my ma, he would always help me ma paint the front of the house blue and white. It was always, and she'd make all the little buntings, the flags. Big, he was a big, big Dub supporter. And loved the Wolf Tones. He loved all his sort of ballads.
Yeah.
And then his T-Rex as well, and ELO and all that type of music. And then George was mad. He was. He was just bloody mad. He was always in trouble, you know. He was 18, but he was always in trouble. Always robbing the gas meter, always doing something. Do you know, he was always in trouble with me dad, you know. Always playing cards. He was a bit of a gambler, you know. Always on betting on the horses and that type. But again, another lovable rogue, you know, that sort of way. Like, and he loved dancing and going out. He was always mitching off school and he was never really ever in school. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, just be murdering the house with him. And then Marcella, God love her, she was only 16. And she did a job in Dunn's in Talbot Street. She loved minding kids. And again, she loved her music. She was big into ska music and, you know, the Beat and Madness and Selector, all that type of thing. And she was always around my mother. She was always buying stuff for me ma and always helping her out and always in and out of the house and, you know, the sort of thing. Like, she's always bringing me to the Dandelion Market and she'd buy me a few badges and stuff, you know, like her favourite bands. And yeah, she was lovely. She was lovely. And she was, you know, she was tall and she had jet black hair and big blue eyes. She was gorgeous, you know, she was lovely. Yeah.
So for people that aren't aware, what was the Stardust?
The nightclub, it was just an entertainment where all show bands and dancing competitions were held. And like, you have to remember as well, like back then, it was the only place really to go to, and it was the place to go to. So a lot of the people that, like, you know, over the years I spoke to, especially a lot of the survivors, like Jimmy Fitzpatrick and Anthony Keegan and all, and when they talk about it, like, they all had great times in the Stardust, you know. But it was a very, very, very popular, like, you had people from all areas going to the Stardust, you know. So it wasn't just like Coolock or Edenmore or Artane and that sort. Like, you had people coming from town and all, like, heading out to the Stardust. Yeah, so it was a massive nightclub. It was a massive nightclub, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just for people that don't know where it's located, it's, if you know where Artane Castle is, there's a petrol station there.
Yeah.
Behind that petrol station, there's a little industrial estate. That's exactly
where
it was. That's
exactly where it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even now, there's a big memorial there. So you're saying it was the place to be, not because it's the only place, but it seemed to be the place to be.
Yeah.
And I even seen Dickie Rock played there.
Yeah.
Oh, from me man that I was talking about.
Yeah.
That was a big deal.
Oh, it was a big deal, yeah.
At the time, yeah. That's before our generation.
Yeah.
But it was a thriving place. So it would have been very busy and very popular.
Yeah.
On the day this happened, what was there an event on that night or was it just a regular weekend?
It was a dancing competition. Yeah, there was a dancing competition on it. So there was a lot of hype around about it, you know, and of course it being Valentine's as well, you know, so everybody was looking forward to going down to the Stardust. And there was a lot of people as well when you heard through the years of people that should have been there and changed their minds.
Yeah.
They didn't go. I'm sure your own parents were probably, you know, saying like, Jesus, yeah, we should have been there or we were meant to be there. Yeah, so like, anybody that went, sort of, they were really looking forward to it and their night out, you know what I mean? Like, and that type of thing. And then, like, even my siblings, like, Willie wasn't going and then he changed his mind. Then he ended up going. George, he was definitely going because he did a day with a girl. And that, from the country. And she, God love her, she also died. Yeah, so he was sort of like, oh, Jesus, no, I'm getting up to Stardust. I met this, she's bleeding gorgeous. He kept saying to me, ma, you know, my ma always remembers those words, you know. And then Marcella, she, God love her, she wasn't meant to be there at all. So she told me, ma and dad, that she was babysitting. And they thought that she was gone babysitting. But I knew she was gone. She had told me that she was going to Stardust because I hid her clothes in the alley-o the little laneway beside the house. So I knew that she was gone. Mm. Yeah, so that, yeah.
I know it's very difficult for you to talk about this whole topic, but do you want to give us your memories of that night and what you kind of remember?
Yeah, I was staying up in my sister's house that was a doorway. So I was up there, and I remember an unmerciful bang on my sister's door, front door, and it was my father. And he ran into the house, and he said, everybody needs to get up to the Stardust. There's a fire and it's bad. And then my mother came in behind him, and she was like, we have to get up there. You know, and he said, right. He said, we know that George and Willie are definitely in the Stardust. We have to get up there. And then, I don't know who it was, but one of them said, and Marcella's babysitting. And then I said, no, I said, she's at the Stardust. And my dad came over to me and he lifted me up. Now, my dad was a huge man. I think he was 5 or 6, 7 or something. Huge, big fireman. And I remember him just picking me up and shaking me. And he said, what the fuck do you mean? She's in the Stardust. And I told him, I said, I hid her clothes in the alleyo. So that sort of always stayed with me as well. Like, why, if I had told him, maybe she wouldn't have gone, you know, but I had to go. That was another thing I had to sort of live with and get over with through the years, you know. And then everybody ran out onto the road, and we lived in a cul-de-sac, you know, like it was like a shoe horse. So, you know,
yeah,
that type.
Yeah.
And the whole, every door was open. Everybody was running out. And I always remember just standing in my sister June's garden, looking at everybody just running, because there wasn't, like, we hadn't got phones. We had no phone or anything. And we hadn't got a car, you know. So back then, like, it was only every, God, an odd person had a car. You get into that car. Do you know what I mean? Like, and then it was trying to get from there up to Coolock, you know. Mm. And it was just a chaotic scene. It was just mental. It was absolutely mental. And then it was like that then for days, because they were searching for them for a while. They didn't just find them the next day, you know. Mm. So it was just like my brothers, like Willie was with Mick Giles and all, they were all at Stardust. So their parents, they were all out looking for them, for their kids as well, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was mental. It was absolutely mental.
And was this late in the night when this happened, or was it early?
No, it would have been. It was like you're talking like 1:30. It was like, it was all around that time. Obviously when the fire had started, and then there was eyewitnesses, and then phone calls started going through to the fire brigade and that type of thing. And my brother Jim, he was actually going to be there that night as well, but he changed his mind. He went out with a girl. Yeah, so he was running up. He was just literally running up to Coolock to look for them. Do you know what I mean? And then it was like that for a couple of days before they found them, you know. Because, you know, every fire engine in the area, like you had, like from all over, had to get to Coolock, you know. And then you had all the hospitals, the morgues. It was just mental, you know.
Yeah, it's horrific.
Yeah.
The story is horrific in itself. And
yeah.
I know you're telling the story now when you're mentioning that a fire broke out. But it's the aftermath of finding out everything.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just as simple as a fire broke out.
Yeah.
With the issues that came along, were they?
Yeah.
Like, also, you're mentioning there, and it's something that I hadn't thought about, of like, this is a 1:30, 2 in the morning.
Mm.
Everyone's doors are open. Everyone's running. Like, that sort of scene there. And for so many families to not find out for, as you say, days.
Oh, yeah.
I can't imagine what that would do to a family.
Oh, days, yeah. Like, it was like an air house even the next day. Like, I didn't see me mother for, God, it was a few days, because they were out looking for them, basically. Mm-hmm. And my sister Breed and my sister June, like, because they were the older ones. And my brother Jim, like, Jim was still searching hospitals, still believing that they were alive, you know, the sort of way. Like, so in the house, like, there was people in, I always remember just so many people in the garden, in the house, in the hallway, upstairs, in the back garden. All Marcella's friends, they slept in the parlour, because they wanted to be there. Where is she? Why can't we find her? Why can't, do you know what I mean? Like, maybe she's injured. Maybe she's, you know, like somebody say took her to a house or to a different hospital or something like that. Do you know what I mean? But when my mother, when they found Willie, he was the first one to be found. And when they told my mother and father that they found Willie. My mother said, the other two aren't coming back. The three of them are gone. So they were her first words, that she just knew that Willie, if he's gone, the other two are gone. You know, because Willie had got out and went back in to look for them and got out again and went back in again to look for them. You know, so she knew that the three of them were gone then, you know. And then George was found, and then eventually then, God love her, Marcella then, she was identified by her teeth. She had work on her teeth. And my sister, Breed, had brought her to a dental hospital. It was in Raheny and Eadmore. And they were able to identify her through her teeth, you know. But she had a horrific death. Horrific death, yeah. They all had. The whole 48 of them had, you know. So there was no sort of, like, yeah, you know.
Yeah. It's obviously hard for you to recount all this, you know. Mm. You're so personally involved in it.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what you know of what happened on the night? So, as you said, it was a dance competition.
Yeah.
The place is packed. It's Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So what is it then that goes wrong?
Well, what happened was they noticed, they seen a fire. There was music was playing. They were up dancing on the floor and everybody, you know, having the crack and that type of thing. And there was a few talk about there was a small fire in the West Alcove and, you know, some people said, oh no, it's only a small fire, it's grand, it'll be put out soon enough and all. And trying to, it's such a, if I was to go through to every detail, I'd be probably here about a couple of hours. But yeah, basically a fire had started and it was noticed on the seating. And you can imagine like the materials back then that were used, like plastic and sort of very, very flammable. And yeah. So people did see the fire, noticed it. They said, well, the bouncers are going to obviously look after it. And they didn't. But because of where it was, it just ignited like in not even in minutes and seconds. And it, as soon as it rose, the flames rose, it hit the ceilings. And that's when then the chaos started. And like that as well, like, you know, there was announcements say like, people don't panic, you know, it's going to be sorted, it'll be okay. But you can imagine all the people, you can imagine all the people up dancing, sitting around and even afar looking at something, it'll be okay. Because you never in your wildest dreams think that you're paying into a nightclub and you're not going to get out. You know, because there's exit doors there, but sure, all the bloody exit doors were chained and locked, you know. I mean, the chaos really, I think, when it really, really, really got bad was when the lights went out. And when the lights went out, then they didn't stand a chance. They didn't stand a chance. Sure, they were trampling over one another, you know, and trying to get to the exits. And a lot of people, I always remember Jimmy saying, that one minute he was trying to remember where the exit that he went, like the entrance, and trying to find his way back, do you know what I mean, to the way he came in to the nightclub, you know, a sort of way. Or somebody else would be beside an exit door and run into that exit door, but they couldn't get out because there'd be that much stuff blocking it from the outside, like bottle bins and stuff like that. And so the more they were pushing and pushing and pushing, more people were coming behind them trying to get out. And then they realized they couldn't get out, so they'd be turning back. And then that's in the dark. That's in pitch in the dark, like, you know. So they didn't know what direction they were going. They hadn't absolutely, they'd no idea, you know. So it was, yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't even write that. It was a horror film.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was horrific.
You mentioned there as well that there was multiple exits.
Yeah.
But some of them were chained, so.
Yeah, yeah, they were, yeah. Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, a good way of even saying it, just to, or if people want to understand it, is even to watch the documentary, Truth, it's called, Stardust RTE made, and it was 3 years in the making, and that explains a lot about the exits and the fire itself. You know, apart from the people that died in it. Eamon Bushley said, like even in the court and in the inquest, he had always denied that they were chained and locked. Mm. Always. He'd never take responsibility for that.
Eamon Budley owned the Stardust at the time.
Yeah.
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 But you said that he never take responsibility, but I watched the documentary.
Yeah.
And in that, there's like news reports of workers who are there that night.
Yeah.
And they said, oh no, I went around and I opened all those exits before I left.
Yeah.
And then he came and he retracted that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like there's video evidence.
Absolutely.
Contradicting them statements.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the scene itself on the next morning. So the actual scene of the Stardust the next morning. Now, so you're talking like it was still burning. Like it was still like burning, you know? And it was like, we have footage and pictures now of kids playing in the rubble in the Stardust. And you can see the policemen and all, like, and some parts of it's taped off. And it was a free for anybody to, that was a crime scene.
Yeah.
That should have been completely, like, no, closed off.
Yeah.
So from the very, very next day, it was corrupt from the very, very next day. It was absolutely, you know, and true, when you look at the documentary, you can see how like people, an awful lot of people would say through the years, well, sure, that can't happen, or sure, they can't do that, or the state can't do that, or but Eamon Portley can't get away with that because he bloody did. He did, you know, and they did treat us the way they did and didn't help us enough and all those type of things. But like, as regards to like all the exits, like the evidence is there now, thank God.
Yeah.
And that's why it was so important to get the inquest. It was so important because the truth would never, ever, ever been out until that was done.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, like that's why we couldn't stop fighting to get it, you know?
Yeah. Selena, how long did it take before they knew the number of people that died was 48? How did that go on for days?
I went on for days, yeah.
Did it?
Yeah. I don't know exactly the length of time it took before they knew the 48, because what was happening was you would hear, I'm sure you've probably heard the story of like, you'd hear one day, oh my, they're ratifying such and such, or it's another funeral, or there's another funeral, or there's two more funerals. So it was like that constantly. You know, for the next few weeks after the Stardust. So it was funeral after funeral after funeral, you know. And then, I always remember, like, I think my ma has them actually, the newspapers of like a 48 dead, you know, and or they thought it was like, say, 26 dead or something. And then the numbers kept on rising and rising. And then it was 48 dead. And then you also have to remember as well that all some of the survivors that were still in hospital.
Yeah.
They still didn't know whether they were going to be survivors. They didn't know if they were going to live or not. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So you did an awful lot of them still in the hospital. It was just chaotic. And then you have to remember, like, when you think of like the 80s, the bleak 80s and that type of thing, like there was no network support for after the funerals, even before the funerals. Like, you know, they weren't allowed to see them. You know, like, you know, you're told your three children are dead and the coffin was closed, you know. So my parents didn't see the three children and it was very rushed, very quickly, you know. And then there'd be another funeral and then another funeral, you know. So that went on for days and days, you know.
Just a little more. I was just going to say, like, this has like been a huge impact in Dublin as a whole for many, many, many years. We were saying to you outside, Selena, that me and Calvin have wanted this episode for years to get this kind of story out there. And because we know there are people who haven't heard of it before.
Yeah, yeah.
But for us, since we were kids, we've always been told about this.
Mm.
Like, this is something that I've known about since the youngest days. Like, my ma would be telling me about how the Stardust and how horrific it was. How big of an impact was it at the time? Like, or did it take a while to realise the impact and the effect that it would have on Dublin and the community surrounding it and the families?
I think from the very next day. I think the impact, they're like the ripple effect in the community was just mad. It was because like, it was all working. It was a working class area, you know? So it was all like, you know, Coolock, Edenmore and Artane and all that type of thing. So it was a very much working class. And so from the very next day, like the effect it had on the community was horrendous because as it was, the Stardust was the only bit of enjoyment that the kids had really. You know what I mean? Like they all worked hard. Like they worked in Super Queen or they worked in the shops. They worked, you know, that type of thing. And they'd go to Stardust at the weekend. So it was like every area knew somebody that had died in the Stardust. So the pain and the grief was huge. And everybody in Dublin knew somebody, belonging to somebody that died in the Stardust. And then a lot of people as well, like, didn't know how to handle it, you know, because there was no network system set up to deal with grief or the pain or anything like that. And I remember we did a live podcast with Vicky Conway and the police, you know, got Lord of Mayor's Center, she passed. And I always remember there, it was myself, Dara, Lynn Boylan, and my sister Louise. But one of the guests on before us was Dr. Austin O'Carroll. And I could have listened to him for hours. He was a brilliant man, you know, amazing man. And
he was on the podcast.
Really?
Yeah, I've had him on before.
Oh, I must actually go back now and look at that. Oh my God. He's an amazing man, isn't he? Oh, he's incredible.
It's a wealth of latent knowledge.
Oh, he is just unbelievable. And I remember listening to him and he was talking on the show, on the podcast about the 80s and how deprived the working class people were back in Dublin, you know, back then in the 80s and all. And then after the show, anyway, we got a great chance to talk to him. And he was saying, Jesus Christ, he said, I remember. He said, Dick, I remember. He said, how in God's name are they going to cope? And I said, no, we didn't. Do you know what I mean? Like, because there was nothing there to, there was no support, you know, even as a kid, like, geez, I didn't go to school for nearly over a year, I think, you know, and because we had to look after my mother.
Yeah.
And then my father was on the drink then, like he got really heavy on the drink. So it was just mad, you know, like it was, and that was like a lot in all the families. That went for, like, it wasn't just their family. Like the McHughes lost their only daughter, their only child, you know, their only child, you know, it was just heartbreaking for them.
Doesn't even the whole process, like, it's not, no tragedy is ever straightforward, but it's not so, like someone's going to say, look, this is what's had to happen in this person's diet. People had to go, and as you said, you were searching, not just the Stardust, they were searching hospitals and morgues, and even if you did find them in the hospital, as you said, there was no guarantee they were going to survive. And is it true that even some families had funerals with empty coffins?
There
was no remains available. Like having to go and identify people and it's crazy.
It was hard. I think that was hard in the court. I remember Maya from RTÉ asking me once, was there anything that really stood out during the whole, because it was a year and back and forth in the court every day and all that. Was there anything that really stood out to you that really stuck with you? You know, and one of them was the pathology reports of how they died, because that was the first time when it was spoken openly in the court of how, say, George William Rosella died, and to hear it, you know, and they were they were being very careful with us and trying to ease the blow, basically, even though we knew, we had already read the reports before it was released in court. You know, we had to prepare ourselves again of exactly how they died, you know. So that in itself, reading those reports again to prepare yourself for the court, that was really hard, really, really hard to listen to, you know, and to read it and then to hear it, you know, because it wasn't sugar-coated. It was, this is how they died. But that's what we were fighting for, was to how they died. And that's why we badly needed this inquest.
Yeah.
You know, but that was very hard for all the families to hear how their loved ones died. you know, and I went into graphic detail.
Yeah, yeah.
Graphic detail, yeah. You know.
Selena, if we ask you anything that you're not comfortable answering, just don't feel okay. Like you have to answer anything.
Yeah.
But how different was life at home after?
Oh, it was mad. Yeah, it was crazy. It was the first few years, everything sort of like stopped and it was silent in the house. So my brother Jim took it really bad. He sort of went missing for a long time. Well, obviously, he lost his two pals, his two brothers, you know. So, and then there was just myself and my sister Louise in the house. And Louise is a year older than me. And then my other two eldest sisters, June and Bree, they kept on trying to look after us, look after me ma. And they had their own families, you see. They had kids, you know, and they were trying to grieve and themselves. Yeah, but in the house, it was my mother locked herself in the bedroom for, well, she would constantly be locked in her bedroom. She wouldn't come out. So you'd try your best to cook something or leave at the door. She might open it, she might not. At that time, like, and she's often said it herself, and she wasn't ashamed to say it, that she wanted to give up. She didn't want to live, you know. So, and then my father, he got really heavy on the drink, because obviously him being a fireman, he thought if he had been there, he would have got them out, you know. And then, like, me mad blame him for he should have been there, you know. He should have been on duty. He should have got them out. And then me mad, and I've often said it, like, he'd blame my ma for not knowing that Marcella was there. Why didn't you know that she wasn't babysitting? So it was arguing all the time. It was arguing, fighting, shouting, crying, wailing. And then you would just hear my ma wailing and wailing and wailing for days and days and days. And then, but that's what it was like. That's how bad it was. And then you had like the neighbors, would just drop in food, you know. They would always like just bring in like bags of food and or say a stew or something, or you know what I mean. And then, yeah, and that's the way it was. That's like our childhood stopped at 11. Mine stopped at 11. So did Louise's, you know. Mm. It completely stopped. There was no childhood. It was completely gone. My memories of it was learning how to cook and looking after my mother. You know, so I always remember learning how to actually cook because my father wasn't going to do it. You know what I mean? Like, and then Breed and June, as I said, they had their own families, but they were constantly in and out. And Breed was constantly looking after, making sure the doctors weren't medicating my mother up to the hilt, which they were trying to do, you know, because they told my mother that she was going mad, you know, but she got the strength up to tell them that I'm not going mad. I've lost three children. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was back then. They put her in the day centre and put a white apron on her and told her to sit at a table and to sew these square materials together and to keep her mind off it. That's the help my mother got. And then they kept on telling her, yeah, we think that she's actually going mad. And then she had the courage to say, no, I'm not going mad. I won't be back here. She said, I'm not going mad. I'm grieving. She said, I've lost three children. One day they were there and the next day they weren't, you know. But that was the help my mother got, you know.
You're talking about the lack of help and network and support after something like that. It actually, I'd even say it was worse the other way because they pushed against us.
Yes, so that's true.
When the funerals and the grieving, the funerals are out of the way and the grieving starts, it actually gets a lot worse for all the families involved. You want to tell us what happens then?
When
it starts to become clear and they get the scene cleared out of the way and the process of what's the immediate aftermath then? So what happens there? So, what's the media? What comes out? What's the details?
So what happened was there was the first tribunal of the fire. Actually, anybody, even there is footage and you'll see my mother and all and Chrissy Keegan and Gertrude Barrett and all the parents basically, and they're at the first tribunal into how the fire started, which was a complete absolute whitewash. Mm-hmm. It was from, as I said earlier, from the very next morning, it was corrupt, you know. They were never going to get a proper result or inquest into how their loved ones died. They made bloody sure that they weren't going to get it. You know, like the treatment was just horrendous. And the outcome of that tribunal was that it was probable arson. That was the only thing that came out of that tribunal, nothing else. So it labelled the 48 as arsonists and every single person that was in it, including the survivors, arsonists. And that was a massive, massive blow to everybody, to the parents, especially the parents, you know. They thought they were going to get a proper inquest into how their loved ones died. They wanted to know how the fire started, you know, and how they died and why were the exes chained? Why was there bars on the window? Why was there steel plates from the inside of the windows embedded into the walls? So they wanted answers to all this, but they weren't going to get it. There was no way they were going to get it. Because Cherry Haughey was a friend of Eamon Bushelly's, the owner. Sure, they even had used false blueprints on the first tribunal of the Stardust. Like saying that there, like, you know, there was a basement in the Stardust. There was no basement in the Stardust, none. It was ground. Their storage rooms in the Stardust was up above the dance floor. So again, saying from the next day it was complete whitewash. And then when the probable arson was ruled, that the findings was probable arson, that's when the big fight started with, okay, we're going to have to do something about this. And Chrissy Keegan and her husband, John Keegan, set up the Stardust Committee. And then the families, the parents, then trying to fight, okay, what direction do we go here now? And then it was like campaign and fundraising, campaign and campaign and after campaign, meeting politicians and to actually get this ruled out, probable arson, you know, because there was no proof that it was. And probable, yeah. What's probable?
Like, there
probable,
is or isn't, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, yeah. I guess, like, what
yeah.
does that mean?
Yeah, like, and that's what they left the parents with, probable yeah. arson, like. Yeah. You know, it was, and when the Stardust Committee was formed, the fight then was to get the evidence, to get that ruled out. But it took 25 years to get that corrected on state record that there was no evidence there to say that it was probable arson.
Yeah.
You know?
Did anyone or did many people believe that it was probable arson, or did everyone just know instantly?
Like, no, they all knew instantly that that this is crazy. They, like, even the amount of feedback at the time, like it was such a shock to everybody that this was the result of the findings of the Stardust probable arson. It was like, this is such a cover up. This is absolutely horrendous. You would get some people that would say, oh, well, look, it's done, it happened, you know, like, move on with your lives and that type of thing. But sure, how could they? How in God's name could the parents move on with their lives? Their lives were shattered. They were ruined. Their lives were nearly finished. You know what I mean? So they had to stand up and fight to get that proven and put on state record correctly that there was no evidence there to say it was probable arson. You know, and I remember, like, I wasn't there the day that they walked out of the government buildings. It was my mother and Chrissy Keegan, Gertrude Barrett, Pat Kennedy. These were all the parents. Antoinette Keegan was there. And I always remember, I still have the papers at home of them walking out of the government buildings when they got that corrected on state record that there was no evidence ever to say that it was arson. You know, and them all crying, like, these parents were, there's a lovely photo of them in the front of the Independent back then. They were all hugging one another and crying, saying, we've done it. We've, you know,
yeah.
You know, but what happened then at that outcome was horrific, was insulting the parents again, was that they said to them, okay, right, it's not probable arson. There was no evidence there. It's corrected on state record, but we're still not giving you an inquest. So they gave it to them in one hand, saying, okay, right, after 25 years, these parents and survivors going in and out, in and out, in and out, you know, campaigning, 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 getting what was rightfully, truthfully theirs to say that there was no evidence to say it was probable arson. And they gave that to them in one hand, and in the other hand, they took it back.
Away, yeah.
And they said, okay, we gave you that, but you're still not getting an inquest. And that then was the big, that was like, Jesus Christ, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Because we thought, like, you know, well, now, like, you know, it's oh, most definitely they're going to give us an inquest. But absolutely no.
But if the families and survivors didn't realise it was dodgy before, that's just the nail there.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dodgy, like.
Yeah.
It's not arson anymore, but yeah, you just can't have the inquest.
Yeah.
Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And I know you mentioned there a couple of minutes ago about people saying, oh, we don't just move on with our lives. Like, I'm sure the families and survivors would have found it a small bit easier to move on if they hadn't made these accusations, if they hadn't made these accusations. Yeah.
It was insulting them.
Yeah.
It actually insulted the 48 that died and also the survivors.
And the community.
And the community, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Labeling them arsonists.
Because,
you know,
as you said, it labels everyone who was in there that night as a probable arsonist. But it could have been someone in the area then.
Yeah.
As probable arson, as you said, it's so vague.
Yeah.
You could label anyone that was around that area.
Yeah.
As a suspect.
Yeah, yeah. You're the cause of 48 deaths.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it was tough for them to hear that, you know. But then that's when the second round of the fight started, you know, saying like, what do we do now, basically? What direction do we go, you know?
Just going back to the forced inquest, after that, when they said it was probable arson, did that then make it okay for them to issue compensation? So Butley got compensated for what happened that night.
He sued Dublin City Corporation for damages to his property, basically, and he won it. And he was rewarded over £600,000. That was a lot of money, an awful lot of money back then, an awful lot of money back then. You got it, you know. There was only two people that was ever charged over the Stardust. And one was Christy Moore.
Yeah.
And the other one was John Keegan.
For defamation.
Mm. So Christy Moore wrote a song, They Never Came Home. And he obviously named Bushley in the song. Eamon Bushley got him charged to get this song not to be played on air, to not to be sold, and for using his name in the song and all that. Anyway, and Christy Moore was brought to court and everything. Yeah. And then all the parents all did a massive collection because he was fined. And when he was, like, Christy Moore at the time was only like, you know, he was still busking in some places, you know, sort of way. Like, and he hadn't got a shilling. He had no money. So all the parents did a rally round and to pay the fine in court for Christy Moore. Yeah. And he mentioned it to me on the day of the commemoration day. And he said it to me because he was asking like for me mum and that. And he said, I'll never, ever forget the day in court when he said they had bags of money, coins, you know, and the old pound notes and everything to pay the fine. But he was charged, that fecker, Eamon Butley, you know.
Just in comparison then, so he got over £600,000.
Mm.
The families were also offered a redress as well, weren't they? What was each family offered?
In the redress?
Yeah.
This redress.
The first one.
The first one, yeah. I think we got 5,000 per child. 15,000. Actually, Darren Macken was saying to us that I think our family got the lowest amount.
Yeah. So this man loses the business.
Yeah.
And gets 600,000.
Mm.
Every family that lost a child got less than 100.
Yeah.
It just goes to show what they thought the price of life was.
Yeah.
But it reeks, it stinks, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I imagine it was probably conflicting for all the families as well, was it, to take the redress? Because wasn't that a stipulation? If you did take the money, you weren't allowed to pursue.
See, back then with the money was, they hadn't got a choice. Their choice was, like, as regards to our family, like the McDermott family, it was the same with all the other families. My parents were told, you can fight.
Yeah.
You can fight the state and Eamon Butley, okay, because of the findings of the First Tribunal. So you can take them on, you can fight them, but be prepared to lose your home.
Because of the cost of it, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My father was told. He was told that be prepared to lose your home if you want to fight Eamon Butley or the state as regards to the findings of the tribunal. So when you were saying, like, you know, what was life like at home, like, you know, as a kid, an 11-year-old, and that's where all the arguments and fights would come in as well, because My ma wanted to fight them, but my father knew that there was absolutely no way they were going to win. And in hindsight, he was right.
Yeah.
Mm. He was right.
Yeah.
They were never going to win that. Mm. And we would have lost our home.
Yeah.
You know? So they knew with the working class people at the time and the families, they hadn't got the money to fight the state or Eamon Bushley. You know, they hadn't got the money. So what should they do? You know?
Was in a stipulation then, if you did take the money, you weren't allowed to pursue legal action against the Butterley state.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
well. So even at that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was catching them in every corner. They had no way out to fight what was rightly theirs to fight for.
Mm.
You know, there was barricades put up all the time, you know, as regards to the Stardust because of the corruption behind it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where they had to, like, after arson was ruled out, and then the fight of what direction do we go now? And it was always, always important to us to keep in the public, the awareness for the public to keep interested in it. You know what I mean? Because you would find some years that the public would lose interest in it and start to start us again. Like, you know, and you can sort of blame them in a way because we were never winning. We felt like we weren't getting anywhere sometimes. But then when Probable Arson was ruled out and that was put straight, we felt we were winning.
Yeah.
But then they said, we were still not giving you as an inquest. We were like, oh shit, like we're actually back to square one.
Yeah.
You know, what do we do? And then it was a fight again. And as well, like for the reason of why the fire started. So all those solicitors, investigators, fire experts, everything that was investigated into how the fire started was paid from the families. That was paid through campaigning, fundraising. We used to have the amount of fundraising we used to have to do, and especially in the old Sheelan and Raheny. You are way too young, but your parents will know the old Sheelan Club. And we'd have like bands playing, but it was constantly raising money. I used to be every St. Patrick's Day or say a football match or something, I'd go into all the pubs with plastic buckets with Stardust, please help to support the Stardust campaign, blah, blah, blah. And some people would, 80% of people would give you money. And then, but you'd always have some smart arse saying, would you ever fuck off? Like, leave us alone, I'm enjoying me pint, or that fucking Stardust again. Excuse the language. But that's what you'd get. And that's what you'd have to put up with. As well, of torment, of abuse from some public. Not all of them, like, so.
Yeah, that's the thing, though, with the probable arson, from when I was watching the documentary, because the one thing that I thought about when I seen this case and the similarities in it between this case and Hillsborough. So anyone that doesn't know Hillsborough.
Oh, God, yeah.
That also happened in the 80s as well.
Mm.
And Liverpool were playing in Hillsborough, which is a stadium in Sheffield. And due to poor management of the crowd, 96 people were crushed that day. So what happened was the 96 people were crushed that day, but then they were vilified and criminalized in the media, and there was all sorts written about them. They were told they were pissing on the paramedics and pocketing the victims and what have you. So what that did was turned the public against the victims, and they were like, well, they probably deserved that, and they shouldn't have been doing this and shouldn't have been doing that. All the world, that's just covering up the corruption, as you were saying.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So when I heard this, so what happened, that they fought for years and years and years to get that down as unlawful killing.
Yeah.
But even when that verdict came in, what happened then was the reason why it was 96 for so many years, and once the 96 are down as unlawful killings in 2022, then I can't remember the man's name who died, but his injuries sustained that day, even though he died in 2022, went down as unlawful killing. Mm. So it changes everything.
But
the similarities then, when you go back to the probable arson, you're labelling everyone in that community. So people are like, well, someone out there did it. So someone out there did it to themselves, self-inflicted, and they had to barricade the doors because they were fucking letting people in, and they were handing drink through the windows, and look at them, they can't behave themselves. So again, it's turning the public perception outside the communities against them. So it's like, oh, that's still going on. Get on with it.
Yeah.
People don't realise the effect it's having.
Yeah.
So what kicked off the drive for the latest inquest?
Yeah, so what happened basically after that then, it was, as I said, we were campaigning and fundraising. And so we knew how the fire had started, you know. So we had to, say, okay, we really have to push this. And we are pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And doors again are being closed in our faces, walls being put up in and out of government buildings. I don't know how many times we were at meetings in the Gresham Wynn's Hotel, you know, with the parents, especially Chrissy Keegan, my mother, Gertrude Barrett, Antoinette, Eugene Kelly, Jimmy Fitzpatrick. There was a gang of us. And it was meeting after meeting after meeting. And we were sort of like getting really worried then, because we were sort of getting nowhere, basically, on the political side of it. The councillors, they were listening to us, they weren't listening to us. They'd promise us this, that. Anytime there was elections coming up, they'd promise us, absolutely, yeah, blah, blah, blah. We'll drive this, do that. But we knew sort of then in the end, like, this isn't, we're really stuck here, you know. And then it was Gertrude Barrett and my sister June, and they rang Lynn Boylan. And Gertrude spoke to Lynn. She's a powerful woman, Gertrude. She lost her son, Michael, a massive Liverpool supporter. Yeah, so she spoke to Lynn for a lengthy time and said, basically, can you help us? We need help. Like, and Lynn said, okay, leave it with me. She said, I'll do all I can. And that's how then it started. And while Lynn then was in communication with Gertrude and the rest of us, Darren Macken from Phoenix Law, he was actually on a flight. He was in an airport and he was on a flight to a meeting. And then this is actually true, because we were slagging him about it afterwards. He went to buy a book in one of the bookshops for the flight, and he bought the Stardust, the book. They never came home. And he read it and he said, Jesus Christ, he said, this is even worse than the corruption behind it. It's worse than Hillsborough. And he, as you know, Darren Macken was involved in the Hillsborough disaster as regards to them getting justice. And anyway, he was in contact then with Lynn Boylan, and he said, do you think the families would meet me? And she said, I think they most certainly will meet you, you know. And that's how it then started. And we first met Darren Macken and Phoenix Law in Buswells with Lynn. And we were just, he was like, we want to take your case on. And we were like, what? Like, oh my God, you know? And so we were like, absolutely, yeah, bring it on, you know? Which we knew the state would be up in arms over, because this was Phoenix Law from Belfast. You know, we had to go north, do you know what I mean? To get some justice. This is crazy, like, you know, after all these years. So at that stage, like, it was 35 years into setting up the Truth campaign with Lynn Boylan. That was her plan of coming up with how we're going to get support from the public as regards to the Department of Justice giving us an inquest, you know. And she came up then basically with the Truth campaign of signing these cards that had a little note to Seamus Wolfe to say, look, we believe that these people deserve an inquest to be opened. And all you had to do basically was sign it.
Yeah.
And then that was going to be delivered to the department. Panel, yeah. Yeah. And basically that's what started it off then. And then we had Phoenix Law on board, you know. So they were legally advising us what to do. And then we had Lynn as regards to doing all the campaigning and getting public support. So for God, I mean, like, for that time through the Truth campaign, we had no holidays. Like, we went north, south, east, west of Ireland, getting all these cards signed, you know. We just didn't stop. So we were going like hail, rain, snow. We were in all weathers, getting all. We were even Croke Park. We went to Croke Park a couple of times, and we were even on the hill and everything. And all the supporters signing all the cards. It was brilliant. Mm, yeah. Especially the young people. Because young people are coming, like, going, like that. My ma was telling us about Stardust. And, you know, and they wanted to know why the T-shirts had Truth on it. Mm. And that's what we had to explain, that because the truth isn't out yet. We need just to know the truth about what happened, how the fire started and the corruption behind it and how they were treated. And their names aren't vindicated yet, the ones that died. So that started, that's how it basically took off, you know. And then we were thinking, like, Lynn had got, like, say, a couple of thousand of the cards printed, you know, and she had to go back to Mary Lou, our boss, and say, I think we need a couple of more thousand, you know. And we thought we'd get, like, a few thousand, even, like, you know, I don't know, 10,000 or something signed. But then we had like 20,000, then there was 30,000. And we had to keep on ringing her going, we need more cards, because everybody wanted them. Do you know what I mean? To sign. They wanted to be able to help. And this was huge. So we end up, and Lynn was like, God, like, wouldn't it be great if we got like 48,000 cards signed? Mm. We could have got 100,000 cards signed. And at the stage, we had to stop at something like, I think it was 52,000 cards signed, because everybody was contacting us. People in America, Australia, that far abroad was saying, we need to sign these cards. Can you post them to us? Can we send them back? Like, you know, people that lived, like Irish people that lived abroad. And it was unbelievable. So it was brilliant. And then we had Dara then guiding us through all the press conferences and everything as regards to what was going to happen, you know. And then we had to deliver all of the, we had them in, you know, those, like, I think Lynn got the plastic boxes from IKEA, you know, the big huge ones. And we filled them all, the cards. And actually a lot of the Carrick Mines disaster, you know, the travellers, they all even came in with us to help us carry. And we literally walked from Pier Street all the way up to Attorney General's office to hand in these cards. And my mother was, we were helping her. She was the first one to hand in the, you know, which was great. So he couldn't just see, they couldn't refuse. This was the people of Ireland now, public.
Yeah.
And they had been refusing us all the time because it was a handful of people. But this was thousands. This was the whole of Ireland, you know, that was knocking on his door and saying, no, you need to. And then we thought we'd be waiting like weeks before we'd hear that we'd get the inquest, that we were allowed to be given the inquest. And we weren't, you know. And I remember being in, I was in my sister's garden, and I got the phone call from, it was the first actually a journalist, Aoife Moore, you probably know her. Yeah. She had rang me.
And, guest on the podcast
as
well.
Yeah. There you go. Today. But she was actually the first one to text me, and then she rang me, and then all the phone calls kept on coming in. You have it. And like Dara and all the Phoenix Law and everything. And then it was like, come on, the show begins now, you know. And it was like, we actually have it. After all these years, we're going to have an inquest into how they died, you know, and then the people will know the truth. And we needed then to really, for the public to know the truth. Because it's like my mother, all the parents, they always said, like, if it wasn't for the people backing them and supporting them, they would have got nowhere. Mm. You know, this was different though. This went a different direction because it was the young people. It was all the young people that wanted to know more. They were eager to know. They wanted to know. And I think of, you know, they couldn't believe the corruption behind it. And but why weren't you listened to? Why won't they help? Why wouldn't you? They give you an inquest. Because it's against the law not to have a proper coroner's report into the death of somebody. But we didn't have one.
Mm.
We didn't have one. They wouldn't give it to us. So that alone in itself was corrupt. That alone in itself was wrong, you know. And all they wanted was to know how their loved ones died, you know. Then all the heavy work then started. You know, and thank God for Dara Mackin. What a man. Oh my God. Absolute. Phoenix Law, they were so professional and in what they do. That's what they do. I suppose that's their job.
Yeah. Mm.
But they were also like so mindful, tastefully mindful in guiding us in that direction of what to expect, what was ahead of us. And especially in the court, you know, all the bad stuff that was going to come out.
Yeah.
And to be prepared for it. And like you know, you're talking like you're in a courtroom that had to be specially made for the Stardust, because the ordinary high court, the courts were too small, because this was the biggest inquest in the history of the state. So you can imagine.
Yeah.
So they had to literally build the court. And that's why it was held in the Rotunda, you know, so in the pillar rooms. And it was actually nice because it was intimate, you know. And the way they did it was the way the families were sitting, they were sitting right facing the other end, you could see the jury, you know. So the jury had view of these parents and the families, you know. And then in the center, you had then rows and rows of all the legal team. Like, I mean, it was sort of like mind blowing when you went into the court. and you've seen it for the first time because you had a row of all the barristers. You had the Dublin City Corporation. You had Garda Síochán. You had Dublin Fire Brigade. You had the Bortleys legal team. And then like all of Phoenix Law. So it was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge, you know.
I could just feel it like as family members and survivors there, could you just feel it as like, this is a moment now. The way, like it took so long to get to this moment. Could you feel it always just nervous about the inquest? Or?
We still, honest to God, we still weren't sure we'd get the verdict that we got, that we wanted.
Yeah.
Because we'd been let down so many times. So because we'd been let down over and over and over again, at times where we thought there was no way we could be let down. There was no way they could say no to us. There was no way that they can do that to us. And we were still let down. So even up to the very day of the verdict, we were as nervous as hell because of that.
Yeah, what was the day of the verdict like?
Oh God, it was mad. I remember like I had to get to my mother's first and get her ready. But I was trying to get her to take her time. I didn't want to rush her. I was trying to keep her in a routine, basically, because of her age. So I had my son with me. And then, of course, then RT, the documentary, the Kenny, the cameraman, he was there at my ma's house because he was filming, was going to the court. I was nervous, but I was more worried for my mother because her main worry was that the battery in her hearing aid was working. So I had to keep checking that it was a new battery in her hearing aid because she kept saying, I need to hear them. I need to hear the foreman of the jury say the verdict, you know. And I said, it would be my bloody luck to rush that battery of it. But yeah, so I remember my brother-in-law, Jerry, drove us to the pillow rooms. And I remember turning that corner and the media, it was just like crazy. It was mental. So I had to make sure my other sisters that were there, I said, be ready to get Ma out when I get her out of the car because I was afraid somebody would knock her over. But they were all so, everybody was so good. Everybody was like, yeah. You know, they were so mindful of her, you know. Yeah, so I actually was the last one going into the court because my sisters grabbed my mother. I was left carrying her handbag, the bottle of Lucozade, the bits and pieces. Everything was gone. They all went. And I was like, jeez, you know. And then the courtroom was just mad. It was packed. Absolutely packed. And it was just like, I always remember looking at the legal team. They were over to the left as you went in. And so you had all of Phoenix Law. Like you had Dermot and Harry, Dara, Colm Dore, all of them, they were all there. And then all the barristers and all the barristers were all huddled together talking and worried and all this, you know, and it was just mad. And then they got my mother to sit up the front facing the judge. And then the rest of some of the parents that were left basically sat at that table. And then I was just sitting behind my mother, just two tables back. And I had Lynn Boylan on one side of me, holding my hand. She was crying before the verdict even came out. She was like a nervous wreck. And I had another very good friend of mine, Rebecca Lawless, that she's always supported us and helped me, you know what I mean, like through the campaign and everything. So she was holding my other hand. Yeah, and then, so the atmosphere was really tense, you know, and then the judge, Mara Cullahan, called the jury out and it was just, everybody was really, really nervous. But you could hear a pin drop, but it was like real tense.
Tense, yeah.
Really, really tense. And my son was sitting behind me with my nephew. And the last question was a question for all of the 48. So basically it was like, have you come to a verdict as to how the 48 have died? And it wasn't individually because they had ruled, they had favoured for the one verdict for all of them.
Yeah.
So she just turned to him and then she'd have you come to a verdict of how the 48 died. And he said it so quickly. It was like, and he just said unlawfully killed. And the place just, I remember just jumping up and I let out. I don't remember letting out a scream. Everybody said I let out a scream, but I can't remember doing that, you know, sort of way. And I just burst out crying. And then my son just came behind me and he grabbed me from behind and he said, "I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. You did it." But I was looking at my mother because I was afraid she'd fall over because she had her walking stick, because she stood up and she got so upset. And then she sat back down and her head fell onto the table. So she was holding her head in her hands on the table. And then she just turned to the jury and she kept on waving at them. "Thank you, thank you, thank you." Yeah. So, and then the place was just, everybody was crying. The barristers were crying. The legal team were crying. We all thought we'd never get over to Darren Macken. Do you know what I mean? Like, just to hug him. It was just, it was like surreal sort of atmosphere. I was raging we weren't able to tape it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I would have loved for the public to see it, for the people that helped us. I would have loved that, the people of Ireland to see that moment.
It's a moment in history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a moment in history. I know, like, you were campaigning by years and years and years and you worked so hard and tirelessly to get to that moment. So you was probably just seeing it as like, this is the verdict now and you just need that answer.
Yeah, that's right.
In terms of people on the outside, for the public, it's just, that is a moment in history. Like,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, like, it's monumental. Like, yeah. And about fucking time.
Yeah.
That's the
moment. Yeah, you're right.
About bleeding.
Yeah, like, you're
everything
right.
Everything that you have been through, every family, the community, like Calvin said earlier on, every single person that was involved, boom, that day, he's got the answer he's needed.
Yeah, it was. It was it was a fabulous day. And like as you said, like for us, it was hearing those words that they were unlawfully killed. That's the verdict that we wanted. That's what should have been said in 1981. You know, and the thing is, people knew, the people in power knew that they were unlawfully killed. It was the people in power, they knew.
Yes, you spent 43 years campaigning to get the unlawful killing verdict. That's coming up to a year ago now.
Yeah.
But that's not the end of the road. What's next? What's left to be done?
Well, for us at the moment, and like I can only talk from our family, I can't talk for the other families, but because they'd have to answer that themselves. For our family, at first, like we spoke to Phoenix Law, Dara, and that after the redress. Or just before the redress came out and then after the redress. And as regards to like, he did give us very, very good, he guided us and giving us very good information or
advice,
as to how we should sort of let what just happened sink in and try to savor every minute of it. Because it was such a momental, as you said, it was the biggest inquest in the history of the state. And it took us so long. And we really wanted to, we were trying to sort of like remember every bit of it from the day of the verdict running up towards those few days of the state apology, especially the state apology. That was a big thing. And the day of the commemoration. That was a brilliant, beautiful day. That was the funeral that they should have had, without a doubt. And so it was either like, you know, we, for our family, we had to say, right, okay, my mum's like, she's 86 now. And when she got that verdict, it was like as if she just, she actually said in the courtroom, which was very sad, she said, "I'm ready to meet them now." You know, and that's how she felt. She was ready to meet them because she felt she had got justice for them, you know, and she felt she couldn't rest until she did that and for the truth to be out there. At the moment now, for our family, we're just trying to look after my mother for whatever years that she has left. We mind her 24/7 around the clock, all of us, you know, and that's our lives now at the moment. Like, you know, we work and we look after our mother and she did it for us. And how she got through it, I don't know. People often say that, how is she still alive? And I think it's because she felt she had to get the truth out there for them.
The campaign that she's led, you've changed the landscape. You've got the public, you've got the government, sorry, state apology in the Dáil. You've got the biggest inquest in state history. Even a few weeks ago there, Donal, you've seen it in Macedonia.
I did, yeah, of course there. Did, yeah.
They came down hard on that. They're hauling people up in front of judges immediately.
That's right, yeah.
They're not wasting any time. There was warrants issued the next day.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think if something similar happened today, what happened 44 years ago, Ireland would follow suit.
Yeah.
There'd be no waiting around.
Yeah.
It'd be dealt with. It got to the bottom of straight away. And that's down to the likes of yourself and your family and the victims, the other 48 victims' families as well, from tirelessly campaigning, showing people that we won't just let this happen. These 48 people are 48 individuals with names and families and stories to be told.
Yeah.
Went out for a night out with their mates and never came home.
Yeah.
So you have to be commended for that. And it's admirable. And I've no doubt this isn't the end of it.
Yeah.
I know you said you're tired and you're right to be.
Yeah.
But I can see this won't be the end of the Stardust. And hopefully the people will get justice.
I think you're right. It's like a lot of the younger generation, like, you know, and in the state apology as well, there was recommendations that we put to Simon Harris that what we wanted, it wasn't about what the state or the government wanted, is what we wanted in that statement, in the state apology. And one of them was that would be in the curriculum, in the Irish curriculum, that would be taught about the Stardust, you know, and certain things like that, you know.
Yeah.
But like, and that's opened up a huge thing in all the colleges. And I've done a few talks in places like, you know, about awareness to fire exits and nightclubs, and not only nightclubs, anywhere really that should have an exit and things like that. So it's opened up a lot of talk between the younger generation. And we even got a few letters, my ma, from colleges, young fellas and young ones, like, you know, just saying, if we ever felt that we were wrong done by, even by the state, you've taught us one thing, and that's to fight back.
Yeah.
And that brought a lot of joy to my mother. She was getting like letters upon letters. Like, we'd go up to the grave in Sutton, and every time, especially right after the verdict, we'd go up, and the amount of letters that would be that people were putting on the grave, just to for my mother, just to say thanks so much for sharing your story, and these are all incredible people, and we'll always fight for the truth and justice and that type of thing. So it's opened up a new, as you said, like a new sort of learning process for the young generation if they're ever wrong done by, especially by the state.
Yeah,
of course.
You know,
hopefully it is on the curriculum.
Yeah,
because it was an injustice, and it shows people the right from wrong and how to fight back.
Yeah.
And thanks very much for sharing the story, because I know it can't be easy for you to have.
No, thank you. I just hope I was trying to remember every, you know, when you're sort of like talking. No, thanks so much. The girls that I work with, I just have to mention them, Pamela Scott, they're big fans of yours. So when I told them that I was coming on the show, they were like, Jesus, no way. Like, can we go with you? I was like, no, you can't. But
listen,
thanks so much. And I really mean that. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Roy Calvin, tell me, this Hurdox thing that you're up to, what is it?
It's a new fitness and endurance competition. You run for 1 kilometre, followed by a walkout like a sled push, then you run again, and you do that 8 times over with 8 different exercises, and the fastest time wins.
I thought you didn't even like running anymore. You threw away your shoes the last time I seen you doing a race.
And it's good crack if you have the right team around you, like the amazing coaches at FPT Gyms, who are officially Hurdox affiliated and deliver brilliant Hurdox classes. I wasn't too sure about committing at first, but they built me up for a lot of hard work, and it'll pay off on the day.
So anyone can do it if they join FPT Gym?
Anyone. Unleash your potential at FPT Gym for only €44 per month with no contract and full class access.
They have locations in Swords, Coolock, Drogheda, and the newest opening in Tallaght.
Sign up today at fptgyms.ie. Take us out, Owen.
Boom.
Talking Bollocks with FBT Gyms. Unleash your fitness potential with no contract and full class access. fbtgyms.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Fill your body up in. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Go down. Go down. Go down.